Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and the Hollyhock God?
McGill, that's right. The Hollyhock God.
I can't believe I got that right. It is episode 155, recorded today on the 21st of June, 2023. My birthday's coming right up, and on my side of things, we got an assassination in the works. We left off with my players in Coyote's Aegis scheming away. I said the session was over, but you guys can scheme away, and boy did they scheme. I had messages after messages of all their scheming, and now we're gonna pick up, and I'll spoiler alert, but I'm gonna pick up like with the next session, and they just get right back to scheming. They're like, "Oh man, what was our ideas last week? All right, let's go through it again." And
well, I hope they don't
more schemes.
I hope they act on their schemes, and they don't just let their schemes be dreams.
Oh yeah, don't let your schemes be dreams. Meanwhile, McGill is doing his best with a very challenging RPG, I would say.
That's right. In the RPG Danger Room, we are going to continue looking at Nobilis by Jenna Moran. And it's a puzzling text. A lot of terminology and a lot of preamble to even get into the rules. And so I'm kind of fumbling my way through it between the source book and all the different resources I can find online. And this time around, we're going to talk a bit about character creation and mechanics, but I don't think we're going to get too much further than that, because I really need to go over some more samples of play just so I can actually like get a sense of how this all works in action. So that's what I always want to do with the Danger Room is, you know, I want to sort of give the summary of the game setting, talk about character creation and mechanics, but then I also want to, like, demo it in some way, even if it's just describing how it works. And it's that last thing that is proving to be one of the biggest challenges with Nobilis.
Yeah, it seems like a very sort of esoteric, metaphysical version of Scion, and I dig it so far. Shall we start off with my side of things?
Yeah, let's do it.
So, my side of things, we're in the forest of Agaloc. McGill, I don't know if I mentioned, this seems like the sort of thing I might have mentioned before, but do you remember the campaign that I ran for you, and Jess and Liam, that was Ashes Against the Grain?
Yes. That's the one where I played Nox, the orc barbarian.
That's right. Ashes Against the Grain is an album by Agaloc.
Of course.
Agaloc being a sick metal.
Hang on a second, actually, now that I think about it, because the past bunch of missions, have they been track titles? Stuff like Goldeneye, and
yeah.
Goldeneye is a track?
Goldeneye is a track on the self-titled Worm Ouroboros album.
Ah, okay. And then Birth and Death and Death and Birth are both tracks from an album?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Worm Ouroboros album, I think it might be that the opening track is Birth and... Let me check that actually here. So the second track on Worm Ouroboros' self-titled album is A Birth, A Death. And the final track, track 9, is called A Death of Birth.
All right.
So that's how I got those operation titles from that.
Because we were in, gosh, we kept getting it confused in the episodes, but was it Birth and Death? The Writhing in the Dark.
Yeah, the one that comes first. No, Writhing in the Dark was Operation Winter.
That was Operation Winter. Birth and Death was the Masquerade, right?
Possibly.
Anyway.
Yes. Yes, it was.
Okay, Operation Winter, and then Operation Goldeneye is the one that tripped me up and made me go like, wait a minute, are these all track titles? But I guess
they are.
Goldeneye. Is that song about the movie Goldeneye?
No, I don't think
so. The game
so.
Goldeneye?
Is there, Is there a type of flower called a golden eye? Yeah, the showy golden eye.
Ah.
Heliomeris multiflora, showy golden eye.
Interesting.
Which kind of makes sense because, like, it makes sense that the thing in Goldeneye isn't just a made-up thing. It actually comes from, like, some... It's like a code.
Well, but what I had known about Goldeneye, the name, is that Ian Fleming called his, like, summer home Goldeneye. So I had assumed the movie was just a reference to that, but perhaps he called his summer home Goldeneye because he grew showy Goldeneye flowers there.
Or maybe they
grew wild, or maybe he just liked it. But yeah, all right. We've traced it.
I mean, that's one possible tracing. Who knows? There could be other things that are called Goldeneye. That Heliomeris sounds kind of cool. Or if assuming that's the part of it, I think it probably isn't a translation there. I'm making a fool
of myself. This is not a botany podcast.
No, could be a bot podcast. Hey, speaking of bots, have you seen this randomly generated Family Guy going on YouTube?
Oh, no, I haven't. But is this is just the latest in these things? I saw one randomly generated Rick and Morty. I've seen randomly generated Seinfeld.
Yeah, I've seen the Seinfeld one before. This one is, I mean, really, this isn't randomly generated because people can control what the scene is, and it just leads to pandemonium. For some reason, Chris in Family Guy in this stream is like 6 times louder than everybody else, so everybody's always making him scream stuff. It's a bunch of pandemonium. Anyway, now I'm getting real off track. Oh, there's something other that I wanted to talk to you about. McGill.
Tom.
I don't know that we've ever talked about music when you're running role-playing games. Do you use music when you run your role-playing games?
So I used to a lot when I did it in person, but I do it way less when I run games on Roll20 because I've found that, I guess because Roll20 is so focused on like audio in particular, that music can sort of get distracting. But in-person sessions, I absolutely like to have like movie scores and stuff on low during certain scenes. And I often pick out tracks for specific scenes too.
I like to keep some tracks on hand for the jukebox on Roll20, but I find that I often forget to start playing them. I'm too invested in like making the scene run that like I don't step out of it enough to be like, and now I press play.
In Roll20, what I tend to do is I tend to do like end credits music. You know, I'll end a session on a funny line or a stinger, and then I'll hit play on the jukebox and play the music. Recently I ran a session where my players went through a whole testing facility. They were caught by the enemy, and then I pulled sort of a GLaDOS thing and had them go through a series of tests to escape. And at the end, I played, you know, This Was a Triumph. Still Alive from Portal.
Still Alive. Yeah. Neat. Yeah, this is something that I'm pretty sure I have talked about on the podcast. But one of the best uses of music that I've seen in games is how, you know, my friends in their games, when they get to the end of the game, they let every character sort of like flesh out their character's epilogue, but part of that is each player gets to choose the music for their epilogue.
Oh yeah, you did tell me about that,
like customization to it.
I like that.
That's definitely one of the, you know, apart from the, like you're saying, like setting up tracks for certain scenes and whatnot, yeah, that's definitely one of the best uses that I've seen, because it becomes part of the engagement of the gameplay, more or less. So that was just something I wanted to ask about music and games. So I hit the players with basically, you know, how much refreshing do you need? As you may recall, we had left off with them plotting the assassination of Lord Dio. And they're like, do we have a solid ish plan? I recall distraction and poisoning. And I had to go, and I was like, feel free to scheme in the meantime. And boy, did they scheme. Alex is like, oh yeah, I was supposed to look over a bunch of spells Connor could prepare. Give me a sec, I'm gonna skim through them. I believe I talked about the possibility of using Gaius to make someone do something. Is that how it's pronounced either? I've been saying Gaius.
Is that how, right? How is it spelled?
G-E-A-S?
Is there a second S? I don't know. See, I know G-E-I-S-S, which I believe is pronounced Gaish, and it means like a quest.
It's G-E-A-S. Well, this is like kind of like a, I don't know, maybe that's what it is. Gaish.
The one I'm thinking of is like a German word.
Okay. No, this one's like, I think that this one has like a Celtic origin or something. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up now. I don't listen to me. So I'm pretty sure also they had like decided that they didn't have that like available to them anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But so Alex is like, okay, so we were gonna blackmail the Insomniomatic dude, right? I remember that. Not gonna lie, can't quite remember what we were gonna try and make him do. Then there was the food tent where Connor might be able to get us a cook to always put poison in, put our poison in Dio's food. And Jen is like, I think the blackmail was the suggested idea. And then Alex says, then we have Operation African Lion Safari, by which he means just activate a bunch of wondrous figurines that turn into big animals and then have them cause a ruckus by attacking the camp. You know, African Lion Safari?
My God, I haven't thought of that place in forever. That's like it's like a step up from Joe Exotic, right? You drive your car through a big sort of open space full of lions.
You only drive your car through that space if you're a moron. You're supposed to just leave your car in the parking lot and go in the bus, but people are like, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna go take my own car through the a wilderness area," and then they get covered in monkey shit. You see them just like coming through like they've been through a monkey shit car wash. It's insane. It's chaos. Yeah, man, I went to African Lion Safari. I rode an elephant. When we went through the African Lion Safari tour that like goes through the big wilderness expanse, the lions started doing it while we were driving by, and like we were in this bus full of tourists that were just like, ah, ha, 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 ha. It was phenomenal. Saw a bird of prey show. I remember there was even some decent rides that, you know, threw me around and whatnot. Good times. And they had a good little song. African Lion Safari.
I remember the commercials. I've never been.
Man, that's too bad. I probably still have an African Lion Safari shirt somewhere around here with an elephant on it. But, yeah, you know the thing, it's an interesting thing having experienced riding on an elephant is that I was wearing shorts and I was like a pretty young kid, but I remember my legs getting pinched by the wrinkly folds of the skin because like my legs were lying along the skin of the elephant, and like as it moves its skin is so wrinkly that those tough wrinkles will like pinch your skin.
Wow. I've ridden on an elephant. That's never happened to me.
Oh wow. Were you wearing shorts?
I was. But it had like a blanket on its back, so I guess that's why.
Yeah, maybe it was the type of saddle that I was riding on. I don't know.
Tom, while all this has been going on, it's been bugging me, this whole thing about Gaish. Because I remember the first time I heard the word was, I don't know if we've ever even talked about him on the podcast before, but the perverted god of teen fantasy literature. Do you know who I'm talking about? Who's the fantasy author for like young adults who has written a million fantasy books all set in the same world and they're all just horny as all hell?
Oh, I don't think I know the answer to this. I don't think I'm aware.
Piers Anthony.
Yeah, I don't know
who
that is.
You don't know Piers Anthony? Holy shit. He has written, God, how many books? He has written so many books. So his main series of books is called the Xanth series, and Xanth is the magical world, and it's a fantasy series. He's written 47 books in the Xanth series, but that's not even close to the total number of books he's written. He's written so many different series. The Xanth series, they're like, I would say they are aimed at an audience just younger than when people get into like Terry Pratchett. So like, you know, when you're like 11 or 12, they are extremely horny and they are full of bad, bad puns, really bad puns. My God. And he even wrote a new one this year. See, the new one this year is called Apoca Space Lips. Apocalypse.
Okay.
Anyway, one of his books is Geish of the Gargoyle, which is where I first heard that word. And I was like, means a quest, doesn't it? And then I looked it up, and it says here, it's an idiosyncratic taboo, whether of obligation or prohibition, similar to being under a curse. And I was like, that doesn't sound right.
That's definitely what the spell is, though.
Yeah. And it is Irish, though the word is also, there is also a similar word in German and in Swiss. And then here I finally actually found the definition I was thinking of, which is the definition from Geish of the Gargoyle, because it's about a gargoyle on a quest. Geish is an obligation imposed magically or by honor. So kind of, again, a bit like a quest.
Yeah, obligation imposed magically is the spell we're talking about.
Anyway, I wanted to just make sure that the record was straight. I don't want any listeners getting misinformation from me about the word geish.
I mean, I got a Reddit here that says it's pronounced gesh with a hard G and an E like the word bed.
Ah,
it's apparently
gesh.
Derived from Gaelic. But then later I see another thing in the RPG Stack Exchange that says, or giash with added stress mark, gish, as in the other pronunciation, long I as in C, and the A pronounced as the E in cinema. Giesh.
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 All right. Giesh.
It's one of those complicated Gaelic words, though, is apparently, you know, makes sense. So they're discussing the idea of the Geesh or blackmailing the Insomnium Attic or Operation African Lion Safari, aka make a bunch of animals attack. And Alex is like, okay, here's a question. When all of this inevitably goes wrong, what do we think's gonna happen? Does Dio get teleported out? Does he have a fast horse nearby? Or is he confident that his guard camp will take care of us? And then Jent is sort of in the middle of saying, like, burn the place down. Oh. And he's like, because, like, he's not just going to go, oh, dear, an alarm. When shit went down in his palace, what do I remember about Dio's exit? And Chantel says he was transported out. And he says, and by I mean Hex, because Alex doesn't remember shit about that. Other than what happened in the garden and fighting a demon in the ethereal plane, which was dope. He's like, but regardless, maybe I know what we do with the Insomnium guy. And Jen says, share. And he says, how do we feel about strapping a C4 to this guy and then maybe geshing him to never take it off? We can catch him isolated. We know where he doses. Maybe even geshing him that he must deliver it to Lord Dio immediately. And Jen is like, ooh, I like that idea a lot. And then he says, and then Connor can cast Forbiddance maybe. And Jet's like, what's that? And he says, it stops teleportation in a 40,000 foot square foot 40, area.
40,000
foot? It costs 1,000 gold. He says, it costs 1,000 gold. And Jet says, chump change. He says, it has a secondary effect where it damages outsiders in the area. Little bonus if another fiend shows up. And I say, okay, to refresh. You guys have a secure hidden location, a low copse, perhaps, not far from the camp. You also have a sniper's nest point that Connor was using that you can easily move to undetected if the guy is not currently dozing on the hill nearby, and even then he won't spot someone if they're already in position. They currently have about 72 hours remaining, and they know it's going to snow in the last 24. Jen says, remind me, we want to see who Dio is meeting, which means we have to do this in the last 24. And Alex says, Gesh can't be used to issue a command that would result in certain death. We might have to force Insomnium Dude to, like, set it up and then run away. But, like, would he even know it was certain death? He's never seen C4 before. How does death have to be? How certain does death have to be, anyway?
Oh, man.
And I say, you have identified a guard that takes little trips to that hill by himself to secretly use Insomnium. The largest tent structure in the area is almost certainly Dio's. There are consistently three militiamen posted at the entrance, but you have observed that the kitchen staff are allowed inside to deliver meals. There were two other individuals you saw allowed inside, appearing to be a knight and a priestess of sorts. The kitchen staff appears to consist of three humans, one of whom was younger than the others. And then Alex goes, oh, wow, Connor could also prepare the spell symbol. And I say a quick rundown of the camp as you know it thus far. Walls, four guards. Battlements, four, two guards each, one alarm brazier each. A kennel, a shrine, possibly to Isis. A big barracks, a kitchen with three staff, one of which is younger. Stables, and a hill nearby where the Insomnium spot is. And then, of course, there's Dio's big tent. And Alex says, symbol is basically old school explosive glyphs, god style. You write a symbol next to the next person to read it, gets blowed up or goes crazy or something. There's lots of options. Jen says, yeah, and unfortunately all I can offer is sneak or pickpocket since I am not human. I say, to Chantel's question, you had determined that whoever Dio was meeting would arrive on or by the third day, so yes. Believe you wanted to wait and see who it was in addition to taking him out. It should be noted, regarding Chantel's last point, that Jen's shadow training lets them literally turn invisible when hiding undetected in darkness. This means you can sneak very effectively, which is how you manage to scope out the camp so well, but obviously once you come out of invisibility, it'll be difficult to re-enter it. And Alex then realizes, Symbol needs to remain stationary. That's dumb. Scratch that one. Jen is like, right, so I would be in the best position to see who is meeting Dio. And Alex says, definitely. Okay, so I think for now, our best bet is to lay low until the meeting goes down, then Jent and Connor ambush the addict, and Jent says, make him C4 it, and he says, gesh him to set up the C4, and then get as far away from the camp as possible without telling anyone or raising suspicions. Then as he walks away, Connor drops the forbiddance. I say, it should also be noted that you have two secondary objectives besides the assassination. The Draelic military asked you to capture Dexter, the guy you dealt with in the mantle before. You were also asked to be on the lookout for samples of a purple gemstone. They're like, oh, right. I say, of course, these are secondary objectives. And Alex says, there's no prison building listed. How would Jent feel about looking through the barracks windows at night like a creep? And Chantel says, that is Jent's third favorite activity. And Alex begins to say, there might be shinies. Oh, okay, never mind. Didn't need the sales pitch ever after all. And I say, how long does Gesh last? Given the amount of time you have prior to this meeting, you'll have multiple opportunities to get to the addict while he's on the hill. Alex says, wow, 30 days. I assumed it was like 8 hours. And Jent says, wow. He says, oh, yeah, okay. So the first night we saw the Insomnium addict, right? So how about night two, Connor and Hex abduct our little narco, and Jent tries to see where they're keeping Dexter. And I say, technically, night one was before the three-day timer. And I say, okay. And then once again, I post this picture of Dexter with the pipe in his mouth. And I say, getting a lot of use out of this one. He was the dude that interviewed you in the mantle. And Alex says, right, shit. I thought we were rescuing an MPOC agent. I'm dumb. Where do we think Dexter is? Barracks seems kind of unlikely. And Jent says, I will insist on his payment on his hat as payment for our rescue. I can look in a cinnamon roll technique. And Alex says, nah, never mind. He didn't seem to be the religious type, and I doubt he spends much time in the kennels. Maybe barracks is the right place to look. And then Gent says, you start on the outside and rotate in. And I say, it should also be noted that Sir Ram, in briefing you, explained that Dexter is apparently Lord Dio's spymaster. And Hex's eyes flash. A roll of cinnamon? What is this wild fantasy? And Gent says, so I break his neck and steal his hat. Gent will take a stick and draw out the pattern of a cinnamon roll. Seems legit. Maybe he's the one who needs to get
poisoned. It's just a spiral, though.
I know. I don't know what's going on at this point, honestly. I just know that at this point, I shared the video of the guy doing the cinnamon challenge and completely failing it on YouTube.
Man,
where it's like, bleh, bleh, water, water. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Where
I was going to say, I actually did the cinnamon challenge as part of a scavenger hunt I was on. I didn't have the same reaction, but I did cough and just like blasted a cloud of cinnamon all over my kitchen.
I mean, that guy, he hypes it up so much. He's like, I will not balk because I've been trained to take pain. I've had things thrown at me all my life. Oh, man. What a funny guy. What a joke.
A diagram of a cinnamon roll. Could be a snail.
And so
could be.
Alex says, so first night you go spy around for him. Second night you poison up and 86 this guy. And I say, just to reiterate, the secondary objective is to capture Dexter alive. Jen goes, damn it. And I say, nothing against taking the hat, though. And he says, so we need to find, bind, and gag the guy, but also make it seem like he left freely so Dio isn't suspicious. Say, also, looking back at the previous session, your general plan seemed to be to poison Dio's food so he was weak, then bomb the place. Alex says, yeah. We'd have to start the groundwork in the kitchen tent to get that going, though. Like, I think the old plan was to gesh a cook into poisoning the food, but Connor needs to get within 60 feet of a cook for that to happen. He's just not the stealthiest orc, or even the orkiest for that matter. He's a half-orc. I say, Gent has so far only scoped out the layout of the camp. They could still attempt to investigate individual tents, as their interiors remain largely unknown. Chantel says, I think the C4 plan has more pizzazz. Gent will definitely plan to do that tonight, though. Hex says, yeah, I do too, but for the first night, since we gotta wait, why don't you check out those tents? Also, Hex is gonna move away from the camp a bit and try to catch some kind of local prey animal. And so that's what they do. He says, is this biome deserty or foresty? And I say, forest. Weird, mysterious, haunted forest? And it's wintry. He says, maybe just set up a couple super basic snares around, like a loop of rope around a bent sapling style, try to catch a rabbit. And I say, Gent, where do you start? And I list all the options from before, the walls, the battlements, the kennel, the shrine, the barracks, the kitchen, the stable, the hills nearby, or Dio's tent. Meanwhile, I make Hex roll survival. I mentioned that the battlements have one alarm brazier each. And so Gent says, alarm brazier. So, like, fire to warn people, like in Mulan. Love Mulan as a reference point in our RPGs.
I was going to say, it keeps coming up.
Yeah, there are. I say, there are four points on the walls where the guards can light a brazier as an alarm signal. That's correct. And Hex rolls a 15 for survival. And Gent says, I would like to go around and sabotage the braziers, like put water in it or something. And Hex says, bury a flashbang in the middle of each. And she says, oh, brilliant. And I say, hey, Hex catches his rabbit. And Gent says, or just a shit ton of C4. And Alex is like, that would totally only make it more alarming. That if you put C4 in an alarm brazier and that goes off, it's one hell of an alarm brazier. That's an alarm that's going to go off for quite a ways. I say, so Gent heads for the battlements. I get him to roll stealth. Gent successfully ghosts their way up barricaded ruins that serve as a wall. Crude wooden reinforcements against some long-forgotten stone arches. Get them to roll insight. As they slip between the guards on the wall, they realize that their attention is very much turned towards Dio's tent in the camp rather than outward. This would make it notably more easy to infiltrate the camp undetected, especially once snow conditions come into effect. And Gent notes that as, like, nice. And so you manage to get right up to the first alarm brazier nearest your team's hidden position. The guard's completely oblivious to your presence. And Gent says, but harder to get in Dio's tent. So I think I want to fuck up the warning system instead of booby trapping it, more defensive than offensive. And I say, how do you intend to do that? They say, what's in the brazier? And I say, tinder, possibly oil, hard to say. Perhaps some kind of dark flammable powder at the bottom. And they say, I don't think I can easily disarm it, unless I have a flask of water, and even then I don't think it'll matter. Oh, do I have a lot of oil? I can make it extra flammable. And I say, you have 5 oil flasks currently, so 1 for each brazier and then 1 extra. They say, I will do that. And I say, I'm pretty sure Hex cooked something up for this mission beforehand. Can't remember what it was. All right, so you go around pouring a flask of oil in each brazier. And they're like, yep. So Jent goes around pouring a flask of oil into each brazier. And Sleepy Hex cooks a rabbit. And Jent says, anything else noticed in the battlements? I say, apart from the distracted disposition of the guard and the braziers, the only remarkable thing would be that the braziers offer wall cover to the guards stationed there should the camp come under attack from the outside. And Jent says, okay, I'm going to hit the I'm going to hit up the kennel back. And Hex says, Sleepy Hex taxidermy a rabbit full of C4 using my cutting artisan trait. And I say, ha, sick, bunny bomb. And they say, really, I just make a pouch of it. But yeah, unless you'll let me. Just have, like, the arming mechanism sticking out of the bottom. So this is something that's come up before, but as a lizardman, Hex has this ability called Cunning Artisan that lets them, like, out of, like, bones and stuff. It's like, use the whole meat. It's like he can make little trinkets out of bones and use animal skins meat. And whatnot. What's that?
In a Tom Lando campaign, it should just be called Use the Whole Meat.
Yeah. So this time he caught that rabbit, and so now he's telling me that he's going to taxidermy this rabbit and put a bomb in it and make a bunny bomb.
I love it.
I don't know if they actually go through with that, but like he definitely brought up the idea and I loved it. So getting to the kennel, I say the barks and growls of hounds can be heard coming from this lean-to. Several large dogs lay in dirty straw. This low structure houses 4 mastiffs. The mastiffs are tied to a rail and cannot move more than 10 feet from the kennel. The whole place is about 20 square foot. A woman is here caring for the dogs. And Jent says, can I roll to see if they are good boys? And I say, you can give me an insight in animal handling for the most information, I suspect. They get insight 19, animal handling 17. And I say, the mastiffs are likely used to hunt down potential trespassers if the guards detect any. At the moment, the camp is not on particularly high alert, and the dogs are neither particularly active nor aware of your presence. Their caretaker seems sincerely fond of the dogs and does not seem interested in interactions with the camp beyond those duties. They appear to be a human drone, though, so it's hard to remember a time you've ever seen a drone committed to such a humane endeavor. It does recall Poppy's fondness for the bat cobs in Citra Arha somewhat. Citra Akra somewhat. Ah, I always got to remember. Found out how to pronounce that right. I think. Man, how do you know ever to pronounce things right?
Oh, you got to feed it into Google and then let the computer lady tell you.
Yeah, maybe. And Jed says, okay, I'm hesitant to fuck with the dogs. Let's head to the shrine next. And I say, you discover the woman you observed entering Dio's tent earlier, apparently praying before the cracked stone Ankh. She's wearing scale armor with a shield on her back and a sword on her belt. Jen says, damn, do I recognize who the shrine is for? And I said, you had previously theorized at a distance that the shrine and priestess were both devoted to Isis, one of the Egyptian death gods that seemed to have a following in the Deathlands that may even predate the Night Side Eclipse's dominion there. Jen says, right. No sign of Dexter? Say, up close, you are fairly certain the woman is a human cleric of Isis and the shrine corresponds with that face. Faith, but no sign of Dexter so far. Jent says, too bad I didn't take the assassin trait. I say, not worth losing the amazing thief traits for such a situational bonus, to be honest. Though yeah, times like these. Jent says, I really don't want to fight her later. I say, at this point, apparently I wasn't feeling well. And so I think I broke the session here. Yeah.
Aw, dangus. I hope you're feeling better now.
I am feeling better now. But yeah, that's where that session ended. Gent scouting about.
Scheming and scouting.
The next one begins, we say, when we left Gent, when we left off, Gent was sneaking through the enemy camp while invisible to scope out each individual area. They'd just been observing the shrine to, you think, Isis, the woman in armor who appeared to be some kind of priest at said shrine. Next on the list was the barracks.
Right on. Look forward to seeing the scheme in action.
Yep, just scheming and scheming, you know? It's just, was a short session. Had to call it early because I wasn't feeling well, but... you know, more, you know, laying out the plots, scouting out the place, trying to plot out how they were going to manage this assassination. Any questions or thoughts on any of that, McGill?
Well, I feel like this was sort of like an in-between sesh, like more plotting out, but not a ton of forward.
Yeah, it's a lot of table setting.
Not a lot of forward momentum yet.
Yeah, with the only real role we did there, I think. Well, okay, we did some stealth and insight in that, but yeah, apart from that, it was mostly just Hex making his bunny bomb theory, or no, catching the rabbit.
I'm curious to see if this bunny bomb thing pays off.
Oh, man, me too. I'm excited for that.
So, Tom, I have a question for you.
What's
when
that?
When you are in the role of DM, do you feel like a god?
Sometimes,
some
yeah.
kind of, some
that's,
kind of.
That's probably what...
Lesser god?
That's probably what, like, drew me to role-playing games in the first place.
Well, Tom...
That and like I mean I think it's connected to like as a kid I always wanted to be a game developer, like create worlds that way.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
And I mean I think that's probably true of anyone who has sort of like artistic talent, creative talents, and gets into role playing games. I mean, like, I, you know, make short films. I always wanted to be a filmmaker when I was younger, and it's the same idea. I want to create those worlds and let people enjoy them, and playing D&D, of course, in the role of Dungeon Master allows me to do just that, create worlds and let people play around in them.
But my world ain't just for everybody. My world's for like three
for the
people.
Cool people.
Three specific people that I've selected out of the entire population of the human race.
Well, Tom, let's talk about Nobilis again. The game where
Hell yeah.
all the players are themselves gods. And
we'll see if we somehow manage to stretch this into another 2-hour episode, but I'm feeling good about this one being one of the shorter ones. So
yeah.
I always feel a bit odd putting out a 2-hour episode of this thing. It's like, who's got time for that? Not
yeah,
me.
Yeah, except definitely
I do,
you.
I do the quality control. Yeah. Except they do the quality control.
So to recap yeah. what we know about Nobilis, the touchstone that I keep coming back to, because I really think it is sort of a perfect one, is Sandman. Like, of all the different properties out there, I think Sandman really kind of represents one of the core ideas of Nobilis very well. The idea of these godlike beings, in the case of Nobilis, they are nobles, who are representative of concepts. They're not just, you know, like, it's not like the god of the sun, where the sun is a thing, we can all see the sun, of course there's a god of the sun, and in Nobilis you could be the god of the sun, but it encourages, like Sandman, sort of these free-thinking ideas, like the god of dream, right? He's the Sandman, he's the god of dreams, but he is himself dream.
He's the endless
the
of
endless
dream.
Of dream, exactly.
The endless of death, the endless
delirium.
Delirium.
Yeah.
Destruction.
Desire.
Despair.
Yeah. They all begin yeah. with D, but
oh, destiny.
Yep.
He's cool.
But again, like, I feel like the endless of Sandman are very sort of representative of either the the nobles of Nobilis or the imperators of Nobilis, depending on who we're talking about. You know, the nobles are sort of like the lesser godlike beings, and the imperators are the greater godlike beings. And so in Nobilis, the player characters are nobles who can be representative of all sorts of concepts, ideas, or concrete things, real or imagined. You could be a noble of dragons, or you could be a noble of birds. You could be a noble of happiness, or you could be a noble of, I don't know, just anything. You'd be a noble of saltine crackers if you wanted.
Do I get to pick what I'm the noble of this
you
episode?
You sure do, Tom.
Hell
and,
yeah.
So the nobles are the lesser sort of deity-like beings, and then the imperators are the more powerful beings that the nobles serve under, basically. The imperator gave the nobles pieces of their soul. I mean, I guess soul is the word they use in Nobilis, but it really is just like pieces of themselves. The imperators break shards of themselves away from themselves and embed them in their nobles. And then so the thing that I gotta go through all this lingo. So the thing that imperators and nobles represent, the concept, idea, or thing, is the estate. It's called your estate, is what you represent.
That's cool. Then
the sort of world between worlds that is like your character's home base, but it's a bit like a pocket dimension. It's a bit like a plane of reality. And it's the domain that the imperator rules over is called the chancel. So these are sort of the core terms that we're going to be dealing with as we go through character creation in Nobilis. And
this is like classic, like mage kind of terminology type of words that kind of thing that they always use in World of Darkness. They're always using highfalutin words.
Very
like
highfalutin. So here, I'm going to send you an editable character sheet, and listeners can find these on themodernnomad.com. Just a nicely laid out editable character sheet. And I don't think we're going to get through every single section of this necessarily, because, I mean, just as with all things Nobilis, it takes a while to even just like explain what each thing is because of all the different terms. But also, like, this is a very kind of, it's a really interesting system where there is a system that you abide by, a system of rules, but it is diceless. It is very much based around points and sort of resource management of your points. And what you can do with those points is one of the sort of gameplay things that I'm still trying to like fully nail down. It's this whole thing about miracles, creating miracles, because you are, of course, a godlike being. But we'll get to the miracles. The thing to start with Nobilis, is thinking of your character concept. Who you are, what you want to be able to do, and then in relation to that, you also want to think of your estate. It sounds like you're sort of coming armed here, Tom. You got an idea?
Yeah. I want to be this, like, embodiment of infestation, which will give me all sorts of crazy abilities. I can have others infest me, so I can carry them around and like transport them. I can split into multiple pieces and like I can become like a swarm, or I can just like hide myself in something. Like I can like get into the walls of a place or something. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that is, I'd say, spot on. You're really, I mean, trust you, Tom, to really sort of identify right away the kind of thing that Nobilis deals in, the kinds of ideas that Nobilis deals in, because, like, you're not even saying pestilence, right? You're not just talking about bugs. You're talking about the concept of infestation. So I could see this applying to things like mold, for example. Just like all sorts of, you know, or, you know, something more benign like bees, a hive of bees. But the idea of sort of like a multitude of aspects of yourself. And I also like the idea that things can infest you as well. Goes both ways.
Yeah, it's the idea of a multitude of things that are unwanted getting into something.
All right. Perfect. Okay, so let me just, there's going to be a lot of me like skirting around on the Noblest fandom wiki.
It's your turn to click
it's
around.
Just so much here. So, yeah, a noble's estate is the aspect of reality that they represent. An estate can be any idea, physical or not. How well a noble controls his or her estate is governed by their domain attribute. We'll get to that soon. But so that's your estate is infestation. Player name Tom, of course. And do you have a character name in mind? Name and age are just, these are just window dressing, really. Like, they don't actually have a bearing on the game itself.
We'll call the character Everett.
Everett. I was about to say Fester.
You know, the first name that came to me was Dangler.
Why not? But okay, Everett. Something about there is something about names.
Should I pick my age?
Yeah, go
now?
Ahead while I do a quick search on this thing.
What does it matter? Does the age matter at all?
No, the age doesn't matter. The one thing that matters, though,
say he's 30.
Is that when you are talking about yourself, you have to
call him Everett,
Everett Dangler. But you also have to sort of give yourself a title. So you're not just noble. For example, you're the Count of Hats. Or you're the Domina of Discord.
Oh, so I shouldn't be? Should I have a normal name? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Everett Dangler,
you're Everett Dangler, comma, and then you can give yourself a highfalutin title.
Okay, Everett Dangler, the Swarm Inside.
Oh, that's good.
We're two lines into the character sheet and I'm already kick ass at this game.
So yeah, estate is infestation. You know, this character, I just want to say, this character sheet has a binary gender drop down. I think you can just do away with that. Especially when we're dealing with like godlike beings. What means this?
Yeah, I feel
that's
like
some bullshit.
I mean, it's funny because even Essence 20 just has pronouns now. It doesn't have a question of like your gender or anything. It just asks what your pronouns
perfect.
Are.
Perfect. Yeah, do that.
Which I think, again, yeah, more appropriate for like endless beings that represent.
I'm just
concepts.
Amazed that there is even like a box at all for gender on this, because they are endless beings that represent concepts. Like, this is totally pointless. And your imperator is another thing that you have to decide on. Now, normally, if we had a party of players here, you know, several player characters, this would be something you collectively decide on. Everybody sort of narrows down what they want their imperator to be, because all the players in the party serve the same imperator, and it should have some connection to their various estates. But you got free reign. You could just call your imperator something like the Hive or whatever. Or I guess the chancel
like to,
would be more like the Hive.
I like to imagine that, like, you know, come up with some things like maybe there's somebody who is the concept of so I am in a party with somebody. I'm Everett Dangler, the Swarm Inside, and then I'm in a party with someone who is the concept of explosion, and then I'm in a party with somebody who is the concept of the desert, or of deserts, and then our Imperator is of fragments, because it's the sand of the desert, the fragments thrown out by an explosion, and the individual parts of the swarm that make up the infestation.
I like that. Maybe the Imperator is just called Fragment.
Or Pieces.
Pieces. I mean, I'm all for Pieces, but I will admit that just makes me think of the slasher movie called Pieces. Have you heard of that one?
Okay. We could call it... No, I don't know that one.
I just want to mention it because it's a slasher movie.
Fragmentary.
It's a slasher movie called Pieces, and the tagline is, "It's exactly what you think it is."
I think we'll call the Imperator Fragmentary. Nice.
Fragmentary.
Because then we're all things that are in some way fragmentary.
And next on the list, you have to decide on your code. And it's interesting that they call it code on this list. This goes back to what I was talking about. One of the sort of difficulties in reading up on Nobilis and trying to figure it out is the flexibility of the terminology. There's a lot of terminology, but sometimes these things have multiple names. So on the character sheet, it says code. In the source book, it is affiliation. So an affiliation is a code that the character follows, often forming ties with other characters of the same affiliation. The affiliation guides the character's morals, actions, and other decisions, though the character is not strictly defined by it. Ultimately, this is sort of like the idea of alignment in D&D, to a degree. I think it's meant to be even less strict. You know, alignment, like, there are some sort of hard lines that you can't really cross. Like, if you're lawful good, you can't just commit random murder. But it seems like the affiliation in Nobilis is a little more flexible. These are just sort of guidelines. So there are five basic codes to which most nobles and imperators subscribe, but there are countless others that exist, and you can fully customize your own if you want. I think for our purposes, just, you know, since we're kind of demoing the game for potential players, we might as well pick from the existing codes that are right there on the character sheet.
I think we've also got one that applies really readily, which I'll explain once we've got.
I think I know the one you mean as well. And here, I'm just going to send you a link. There is a list of the codes from the nobilis.fandom.com wiki. On the character sheet, they are marked as heaven, hell, light, dark, wild, and other. But they have much bigger names. So there's the Code of the Angels, which is heaven. And its three principles are: beauty is the highest principle, justice is a form of beauty, lesser beings should respect their betters. So it is, there's a degree of hierarchy imposed there, where you should respect those more powerful than you. Justice and fairness are a priority, and beauty is the highest priority here. There's the Code of the Fallen Angels, which is hell. Corruption is the highest principle, suffering is a form of corruption, and power justifies itself. Pretty self-explanatory in those. There's the Code of the Light, which is humanity must live and live forever. You're trying to ensure the ongoing survival of humanity. What must be done ought to be done cleanly. Humans must be protected, particularly from themselves. So it seems like the Code of Light is very much like intervening in human affairs to ensure the survival of humanity as a whole. But do it cleanly. The Code of the Dark: humans should destroy themselves individually. Humanity should destroy itself collectively, except for a few key toys. And ugliness to human eyes shows that one is worthy. So even more than the Code of Hell, I feel like the Code of the Dark is really like the demonic, like chaotic evil one. Like they
I mean, the classic thing in Dungeons and Dragons is that devils are the lawful evil ones and demons are the chaotic evil ones. And I definitely, yeah, there's a difference here of like the idea of corruption versus the idea of destruction.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that the Code of the Dark even says like ugliness is a priority here. So like your noble, if they follow the Code of the Dark, should be some really, really hideous, awful to look at being. And then the Code of the Wild. Freedom is the highest principle. Sanity and mundanity are prisons. And given kind with a gift received. So given kind with a gift received is neat because it really does sort of suggest an even-handedness. Maybe the Code of the Wild is kind of like, you know, the wild may refer to more like the laws of nature. And it seems almost like the more neutral of these codes.
Maybe chaotic neutral because it doesn't like sanity. True. But so which do you think I'm
was
pick?
Thinking the wild.
So was I, particularly with this like imagined party of like explosions, desert infestation. I think that's wild.
Yeah, things like explosion, desert, and infestation all definitely speak to freedom as the highest principle. You know, desert being this vast open space, explosion being like an eruption, like all the particles in an explosion are erupting freely outwards into the world, and then infestation is
about breaking
exactly
boundaries,
inhabiting wherever you please,
exceeding borders. Yeah.
So the Code of the Wild. And now we're going to get into the mechanics a bit. We're going to talk about the attributes, but there are also like little sort of tangents that I'm going to go on related to the attributes. I'm looking on this sheet. I don't even know where that one goes. We'll get to it. So in a round, like when action is happening, in a round, a player may make a mundane action and a miraculous action. So a mundane action is performed with the mortal part of the body and soul, and then a miraculous action uses one of these attributes. Nobilis has these attributes that I will describe, and this is sort of what they do and how they work. So first up is aspect. Aspect, the single stat that controls all physical and mental abilities. So you get out of the way, you get all that stuff out of the way very quickly to make room for some magic. An aspect 2 character can beat nearly all humans at any given task. An aspect 4 character can throw a baseball into the sun. An aspect 5 character,
this is just
can
like
catch
Scion.
Bullets. An aspect 6 miracle lets you memorize literally everything that's ever been written. And that's just sort of like the baseline that we're talking about.
Those are just some things I might do.
Domain is the primary attribute for messing around with your estate. So as I said, you're not just a noble. You are the swarm inside. Is that right? That difference emphasizes the importance of domain. It's a level 3 domain miracle for the Noble of Hats to preserve a hat so that it never gets worn out. A level 4 miracle allows the Noble of Hats to create a beard hat that gives the wearer a real beard. A level 4 domain miracle for the Noble of Discourse, for example, can convince a person to drown himself. This makes discourse sound more powerful than hats, but it's a little more complicated than that. Basically, these different levels of miracle, like the higher the level of miracle, the more sort of seemingly impossible the thing would be. The miracles fed through these attributes allow you to alter reality to various degrees as your character. I think I got that right. The realm attribute is power over the chancel, which is, as I said, the home for the party, the base of operations a plane that exists just out of time and space. Realm is the ability to do what somebody with domain can do, only instead of being limited by concept, you're limited to a certain space. So, like I said, it's your chancel. Realm allows you to do stuff in your otherworldly base of operations that the Imperator lords over.
I need to get a high enough realm that I can infest someone else's chancel.
That's a good idea. Spirit is the fire in your soul. Increasing it allows a noble to better resist the miracle powers of others, as well as split their own soul and plant drops into mortals. What this does is turn them into anchors. They become your eyes, your ears, your minions, allowing you to participate in scenes where you aren't physically present or advance various goals in absentia. A high spirit score empowers specific magical rites, some of which have devastating effects. Now, this mentions something about Nobilis that I think is pretty cool and elegant. Anchors. As it says here, like, anchors are effectively your noble's minions. And so something like infestation, like, your anchors could be insects, of course, vermin of any kind. Your anchors could be, I mentioned, mold or, like, mushroom spores. I'm sure, like, I'm waiting for you to chime in and say one of your Tom Lando things that I never would have thought of.
Oh, man. Discarded food.
Oh, trash. Trash is perfect. Yeah, you could be the trash infesting hoarders' homes. And spirit allows you to basically create more and more anchors. And what I think is really cool about Nobilis and the concept of anchors is it means that all players are present for all scenes, even if their character isn't present. Huh? So, okay. So any scene that, like, someone's character isn't in, that person can still look in on the scene, you know, keep an eye on things, listen in on the scene, or even take part depending on what anchor of theirs happens to be present. With your noble of infestation, Tom, you can literally be a fly on the wall of any conversation.
Yeah.
I just think that's really cool because it means that you and I have even talked on the podcast, I want to say pretty extensively. I know I, like, brought it up in the tavern at one point, but specifically splitting the party. We've had all these conversations about, you know, do you split the party? Don't you split the party? This completely takes that out of the game. It doesn't matter. You can split the party, you know, split it, don't split it. Everybody's there whenever they want to be. I like that. And it's not on this character sheet, so this could be a leftover from second edition Nobilis, but I'm going to mention it anyway because it is like... It's like this is a third edition thing. Persona is a new attribute as of third edition, the power over the properties of your estate. What are properties? Well, maybe discourse is a battle of the minds and a force that proves truth. With a persona of three, the Dame of Discourse can force the power of truth to her words. With persona five, she makes a person stupid forever. But maybe she instead defined discourse's properties as a method of communication, which is used to unify and creates understanding. Now, with Persona 1, she can bring peace on a man of two minds, or with Persona 4, she can make a room full of CEOs donate their wealth to charity. I mentioned last episode that all the writing online, there's very little distinction made on the part of the authors between whether they're talking about second edition or third edition. So Persona, I guess you and I aren't going to deal with it. It's not on the editable character sheet that everybody was referencing, but it sounds like as of third edition, they're adding an additional ability that allows you to specify more or stricter guidelines, I guess, in how your estate operates. The write-up here that I was just reading seems to indicate, like, you know, if somebody's playing the Dame of Discourse, a Noble of Discourse, they can use a high persona score to redefine Discourse's properties to make them peaceful, enabling of understanding, and more of a method of communication than a battle of minds. I guess, man, I don't know. I'm just trying to work it all out.
I mean, I like having four because something tells me I'm going to have a limited number of points to spend on these, and the less I have to spread them out over, yeah, the better.
Oh, well, let's start investing some points, but just trying to see if there's a, yeah, there is a place here. Before we even get to the points, though, there's one more thing we need to talk about, and that is your character's bonds. Bonds are the things that matter to your noble. The color green, winning, a good BLT, whatever you want. These have mechanical meaning, but they also serve to flesh out a concept. And let me just see if I can find a full write-up here on bonds. Bond is what your character values the most. It can include nobles, estates, chancels, anchors, or imperators, but it can also include intangible things like hobbies, items, vices, places, or people. Each character has 20 bond points that they must divide according to the importance of a given bond. While this gives detail to your character, the Hollyhock God may give penalties for players who forget their bonds or chose a less important bond over a more important one in any given circumstance they might face. So these are the things that are most important to your character, and yeah, the bond points. I'm trying to figure out what that means. We're not going to have to divide those up yet, though. Don't worry about them yet.
Okay. What I'm thinking is I need to know, you know, what's the maximum number of points a bond can have? What's the scale like here?
Bonds are a statement about your character that is under your control. You can get around it by declaring that something doesn't count. You use bonds to overcome value points of opposition or obstacles for an action. You can use them to earn miracle points by getting you in trouble or allow you to overcome a lack of food, sleep, or air. A level 2 bond says, as an example, a level 2 bond, I am a huge nosy Parker, will net you +2 to delving into someone's affairs if there's opposition or an obstacle. It earns you 2 miracle points when your prying annoys an ally, or it allows you to spend all night lurking in someone's fridge to spy on them. Boy.
I mean, I've got one thing right off the top of my head that I feel like I'm going to put under bonds is infiltration, because that's one of the things that's most important to me. It's just like, yeah, getting in.
Reading up on this, I'm getting the impression that bonds are, I don't think that there is any maximum number. Everywhere I see it, it says each character has 20 points to divide among their bonds. Each bond receives a rating, its bond strength, that reflects how important that bond is to the character. These assignments are flexible but should not be abused. But also, I'm getting the impression that bonds should be phrased almost similarly to something like from City of Mist or Blades in the Dark. The example I have here is a bond called I Never Lose a Sword Fight with 3 points in it. If you have I Never Lose a Sword Fight 3, then that means it's important to you to never lose a sword fight. You expend effort to ensure you never lose a sword fight. In order to fight with a sword, you have to use a mundane skill or a miracle as the base action, but that when you do, you can invoke your bond to get a strike. In other words, the bond means that the actions you take to win a sword fight have extra heft compared to other people's actions, but the bond on its own won't win the sword fight for you. It also means you have to declare what situations your bond applies in. Maybe you can let somebody win this time because you're just in a sparring match. This isn't a real sword fight.
So I could rephrase it as, I have to get
That's
in.
That's good. Yeah.
So then anytime I have a, you know, have to get in somewhere, I have a bonus at that, depending on the number of bond points I put
yes.
in?
Yes.
Interesting.
Beyond the base points,
I feel like
yeah, sorry.
Most things in this game seem to be rated similarly to World of Darkness out of 5 or in increments of 5, so I feel like I'd probably measure my bonds out of 5.
I mean, that makes sense. Okay, here we go. That makes a lot of sense.
I'm putting another one that's friends in low places.
I like it. Oh my gosh. Okay.
Maybe instead of I have to get in, it could just be let me in. Let me in. But that's not really the same. I'm not being let in.
You were right. During character generation, bonds cap out at 5.
Perfect. Need to figure out how many I have then. But I've got 2 so far.
Friends, I like friends in low places. I could see that one having a lot of utility.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't come up with any other bonds
all right,
yet.
Note them down and just note down that you still have your pool of 20 points to spend in that area.
Yeah, I have to get in and friends in low places.
So now we can do a bit of number crunching. Each character starts with a pool of 25 character points. And the common award at the end of every session is 1 character point, or maybe a few after you complete a story arc.
Ooh, I'm going to do another bond, and it's going to be makes your skin crawl.
Nice.
I can always unnerve somebody. Sorry.
So you have 25 character points. 1 level in an attribute costs 3 points, and attributes during character generation can max out at 5, allowing a noble to trivially do miracles up to that level. And level 0 miracles do have a meaning as well, so if you have 0 in one of your attributes, don't worry, that counts too.
So is each rank
yes.
3 points? Okay.
And, you start. Okay, wait, sorry. You start with 5 for each attribute. No, you start with 5 miracle points for each attribute. I see it there. Yeah.
Yeah, I see it in the sheet.
And then you have 25 to spend. There are more things that you'll be spending your character points on.
Oh, okay, cool. So do I pick that now?
You can, if you want, you can buy some levels in your attributes. Or if you want, you can sort of bank the points and I can talk a bit about other things that that you can spend them on too. So you have a better sense of how to allot them.
I do like the way that the attribute title changes depending what I set it to.
Yeah.
These are pretty cool. I don't know. I feel like I could handle staying mortal or maybe go 1 point in aspect. I think aspect is one of the ones that appealed the least to me. Domain probably doesn't have to be that high, but Realm is one I definitely wanted to be, like, since there's so much about my character that's about inhabiting a space, I think that Realm is, like, the one I should really be focused in. And Spirit is just kind of, like, the level... Is that sort of, like... What is Spirit again?
Spirit... increasing Spirit allows a noble to better resist the miraculous powers of others, as well as to split their soul and plant drops into anchors, which are, like, your minions and things that you represent, I guess. Your eyes, your ears.
And so it's 3 points for every... 3 character points for every attribute, for every, right?
That's right, point? For every rank and attribute.
So if I have 1 point in each to start with, then that costs me 12 character points, right?
Yes.
And then I could spend 15 to have one more in something, which I'd probably go Realm. That makes me Metahuman Aspect, Baron Domain, Realm's Heart for Realm, and Hearthfire for Spirit. So what else have we got?
Well, we've got...
Because there's other things I can spend
these
on, right?
And this is the big one. This is probably going to be the last thing that we cover on this episode because I'm having a hard time finding, like, concrete answers about it. But it's gifts. Gifts. Gifts are a step further in customization when comparing to attributes. Gifts are like... they're like minor miracles. Well, depending on how many points you invest in them. Like flight or fire breathing are 1 point. The ability to inspire lasting devotion in all who see you is 2 points. Perfect timing, taken at a 5-point level, can cause accidental time travel. Immortality costs 6 points. So... but see, gifts are like highly customizable. I'm just looking at.
Yeah, I'm noticing like you set the attribute, you set the miracle type, you set the penetration, the invocation, the area, the flexibility. It's like creating a spell in Mage.
That's probably a good touchstone for it. Here's a blurb from forum.rpg.net. A gift is basically a pre-built miracle with a few restrictions. The reason you'd buy a gift is that it's cheaper than buying sufficient ranks in an attribute to pull it off. Or because it's something outside of your domain. The Dominus of Confusion, for example, has a memory-stealing gaze, which is built as a lesser destruction of memory with a few restrictions. Actually, erasing memories isn't part of the estate of confusion. So it's a useful trick for him, and because of the restrictions, it only costs 2 character points. By comparison, having enough domain to pull off a lesser destruction of memory as a simple miracle would cost 15 character points. I can't tell, Tom. This is the problem that I have with games like this, is I can't tell if what this person has written is referring to, like, specific things that I just can't find in the source book, or if the idea is that the player and the Hollyhock God together decide on the cost and balance of each individual miracle, or gift, rather. Because I get the sense that, like, you know, that a lot of this is about customization. A gift is purchased at character creation and can be used by a character any time they deem necessary without the need to expend miracle points. A single gift can do anything from a single task to several of them separately. Only imagination and the Hollyhock God's judgment limits its creation. Gifts...
So, but there's some math here to it I'm noticing in the character sheet, because you pick the attribute, then the miracle type has an associated number with it, whether it is lesser divination, preservation, creation, destruction, or change, or major of any of those. Those all have a different number associated with them. Then you choose the penetration, which I'm not sure how that scales relative to the cost. But then invocation can be automatic, simple miracle, which decreases the cost of the gift by one. Normal miracle decreases it by two. And hard miracle decreases it by three. Area is increased by one if it is global. Basically there is a math to it that is all kind of laid out in the character sheet. That I could sort of see, like, I haven't, like, the thing is, I don't have the full thing of, like, what, I guess the, like, in the example it gave there was destruction of memory, and I can see how you would make a destruction of gift, but I guess memory would have to be their estate or something. Like, maybe if I say my gift is lesser preservation of infestation, and that just lets me maintain a swarm in an area. And then my invocation could be simple miracle. I'm not sure what that means, but it decreases the cost a bit. The area should be local, not global, and that would be reduce the cost by one. So now we're at a cost of one, because it lesser preservation was three, a simple miracle is minus one, and local is minus one. And I could go flexibility full to make it, that's plus one. I make it common for no particular bonus, and then estates is single, which multiplies the cost by one. So total, the math comes out to two. The cost of that gift of lesser preservation, a simple miracle that in a local area preserves infestation. I don't know what flexibility is, but I gave it full. You know, there's some things missing here, but there is, like, enough here that I can at least figure out the math that they're telling me to input.
Well, I've got the section in the source book that focuses on gifts, and I can tell you what flexibility means even. But I think we keep coming up against miracle points. So I think maybe now is the time I need to talk about miracle points, right? So each power starts with five miracle points associated with the attribute, right? Five aspect miracle points, five domain miracle points. You can see them little X's on this character sheet. You can buy additional miracle points for character points. Each character point you spend buys one extra miracle point for all four types. So for all four of your attributes. During the course of play, you will spend miracle points at sometimes a frightening clip, and you aren't guaranteed to get them back until the next story begins. The Hollyhock God can give you extra miracle points or an early miracle point refresh for any reasons that they have listed here. Oh boy, God, I did it again. Now I'm like, I'm wading into this. I found just the section on miracle points, but it's like, it's pointing me in all different directions. But in relation to it is the section on gifts. So sometimes powers can do things that don't make sense as part of their estate. You know, why could the power of storms breathe fire? To have abilities like this, you have to buy... See, it says here you can buy your avatar gifts. Your avatar is your noble. Just call it that.
Yeah.
Gifts are basically miracles that your noble can do or that the world performs for them. They're the system that we use for building generic noble imperator and excrution abilities. Excrutions are like the bad guys in this. There's a list of these gifts in the source book, but not most of these... There's a list of these gifts in the source book, but more important than the list is the design system, because it allows you to make your own gifts as well. customizing your noble's more eccentric abilities.
But that is good to know that there is like a list of gifts in the book. Interesting. So I could just pick
so I'm gonna
save me the trouble of all this math.
Aspect gifts. Do you want to be able to do some kind of aspect miracle that your aspect level doesn't allow, or the aspect rules don't allow? Remember, aspect is like physical things, so like, you know, run as fast as the Flash kind of a deal. Pick a passion or skill that governs the kind of thing you want to do and the miracle level you want to do it with. It doesn't have to be one of your own passions or skills. For example, an aspect 4 level skill, science. An aspect 3 level skill is martial arts. An aspect 6 level passion is I can save everybody. This is the basis for an aspect gift. Domain and persona gifts. Do you want to be able to do some sort of domain or persona miracle, but it doesn't fit your estate? Or maybe it's more powerful than what you can do with your domain and persona? Pick an estate, a miracle difficulty, and a basic miracle type you can do with that level of domain or persona miracle. The miracle type is everything gathered under one heading in the domain and persona miracle lists. Domain 8 level major destructions of color. Oh, sorry. Domain 8th level major destructions of color. Domain 3rd level lesser preservation of cats and dogs. Persona 2 level lesser incarnation in dreams. Okay. Many different estates. If you can do miracles based on many different estates, double the final cost of the gift. For example, gifts that do domain miracles of any living thing or any emotion or any form of matter have double cost. Boy.
Yeah, so I did cover that in the in the math. I picked single estate.
Treasure gifts. Do you want to have some kind of cool artifact or collection of artifacts? But for some reason, such as miracle point cost or not wanting it to be a bond or feeling that it's anti-thematic for your estate, you don't want to buy it through treasure. Pick a focus. Which function exactly is anchors, save that they are not connected through your bond, and the treasure miracle type you'll use to manipulate it. A level 3 treasure gift is a supercar. A level 5 treasure gift is an amazing sanctum. You may access effects up to that level, but only regards to that focus. Active immortality. Here's an example gift to build using the system. Let's say you want your character to be immortal, not the passive I can't die sort of immortality, or even the I'm really good at not dying sort, since those are better handled through bonds and afflictions, but the active whatever it is, I can take it, reflexively shrug it off, and just keep on coming kind of immortality. The kind that lets you declare I defend against any sort of attack. That kind of immortality would be considered a gift. The base cost for your gift in character points is the miracle level you've chosen. If you want to pick a miracle level that's higher than what you need in order to win miraculous contests, you can, but we're not going to do that in our sample gifts. You want to be immortal. A Persona 3 miracle of true love might do it. Or some sort of Treasure 6 laughter-based anti-death serum? But we're going to go with a Domain 6 miracle over you. The idea that something's happened to you. And maybe it's a nuke or a knife, or maybe it's something subtle and clever that you'd have a hard time defending against, but it doesn't matter. Your active immortality kicks in, it steps up to the plate and says, I defend you. This has a base cost of 6 character points. there are charts here. Flexibility. Different kinds of miracles you can do with your gift. They keep coming back to active immortality. Okay, here we go. Here we go, Tom. I think this might help us out. Here's the section of the source book on common gifts. All right? It seems like these are the ones that all these people writing stuff out. They all seem to be sort of using these as reference points. So, flight. You can fly. It's a common gift. If you want to have wings or a jetpack, you buy that with a treasure miracle. So, miracle level 3 costs 3 character points. Invocation, if it's automatic, that adds a character point. Range, if it is self only, looks like that's a discount of 3 character points. Utility is 1 trick. Common says yes. And so after all the math, the total winds up being just 1 character point for flight. It happens automatically and only on yourself. This has the advantage that your wings are always there and always active. So you can use mundane and aspect actions to soar the skies. However, if you want to telekinetically fly yourself around, you can buy that as a domain-based lesser animation of self. And it also only costs 1 character point, but it is a level 4 domain miracle. It's simple, which gives a discount of 1, and its range is only on yourself, which gives a discount again, and then it's common, and the math works out, so it only costs 1 character point. Both of these gifts have plenty of room for customization and improvement. If you want self-motivated wings that can yank you out of the way of danger and sustain long periods of flight without using a sustained miraculous action, you can upgrade your treasure gift to a level 4, or the domain gift to automatic without changing their final cost. Oh, I see. So the domain version, the invocation is simple, so it doesn't happen automatically the way it would with having wings. Your wings are always there, so you can automatically always fly. But if you're flying telekinetically, you have to focus on it, and so it's a simple invocation.
Right. So I had said that lesser preservation of an infestation or swarm would be... I guess I would work this out with you as the Hollyhock God, but I think that is a simple miracle. It is local area. What is flexibility, though? That's what I didn't understand.
Flexibility.
Because it can be full, comprehensive, limited effect, or one trick. One trick was listed when it was talking about the fly. I guess it's the... Like, if flight is a one trick, then that means that you can only really use the flight for that one thing, I guess. Whereas, like, if it's full flexibility, then it's one of these, like, one of these noble powers that you can sort of, like, bend the
yes.
rules of.
And under flexibility, you know, because there are aspect-based gifts, domain-based gifts, treasure-based gifts. Each of these has, like, a chart. That
what I notice is that treasure based, like aspect and domain are attributes, but treasure is
that's
not.
Right. Treasure seems to relate to like things that your character has. So like the treasure based gift of flight, you have to have a jetpack or wings, like a physical thing.
It just seems interesting to me that there are aspect and domain gifts, but then there aren't realm and spirit gifts. There are treasure mm-hmm. gifts instead.
It is strange.
Also, this character sheet seems to slightly disagree on that, which maybe it's an addition thing.
But I don't know. Again, like
it doesn't list the option to.
I have a hard
treasure.
Time finding writing online that doesn't disagree with itself in the same way. Like this is, there are more resources for this. By a long shot than like Wisher, Thayer, just Fatalist, for example. But even so, everybody still seems kind of confused by it. and it feels like that Mornington Crescent game that we talked about where, like, as I read about it, I start to wonder, like, do these people actually all know what they're saying? Or are they just, like, making it up so that they seem like they know what they're saying and the joke is, like, creating an in-group, even though it's all just made-up jargon. I mean, I get the sense that it's not the latter, but it feels like that when I read this stuff.
But the gifts, it's funny because the gift system seems very familiar to me from Mage, because Mage has a very similar system whereby you have your general traditions or your I can't remember what they're called, but your general things like your magic types like matter or mind or Try to think what the other ones are. Spheres? I think they're called spheres. No, they were spheres in Ascension, but that's still right. It's entropy, force, life, matter, mind, prime, spirit, time. Like, you have your points in those that are generally, like, that is the type of magic that you are specialized in, and you can do that type of magic. But then for the benefit of having spells that you can do off the cuff, you have what are called rotes. And that is what these gifts are like, where it's like, you may have your general ability to, like, work in a certain type of magic, but for the convenience of having something you can just throw out the way you throw out a cantrip or spell in Dungeons & Dragons, then you design a rote, which has, like, a specific sort of limitation and cost to it, with it that is established within what you can do by your attributes.
Well, okay, here. What kind of gift was the one that you were inputting there?
I mean, I had just sort of made up. I had just sort of been using the pieces, but the idea I had was basically an ability to preserve swarms, where basically, like, even if something would disperse a swarm, instead I make it just stay and I can control it.
That seems like a domain-based one, right?
Yeah, I think it's a domain-based preservation.
So here, okay, yeah. A domain-based, maybe like lesser preservation.
Lesser preservation of storm of swarms, sorry. That's
so
what I was
thinking.
So
here is the flexibility table listed in the source book. Decide how many different kinds of miracles you can do with this gift. For domain-based gifts, here's the different flexibilities. So these are different options that I'm reading off. Option one, all domain miracles of a specific type for that estate, for example, lesser preservation. So your gift affects all domain miracles of a specific type for that estate. If you choose that option, it adds a cost of one character point to the gift.
And that's what I went with.
Option two, a large, flexible subset thereof, but missing some obvious utility. So, a little less utilitarian, but it still encompasses a subset. That gives you a discount of minus one character point. Option three, just a handful of applications. Gives you a discount of minus two, or one trick, means there's just one thing it can do, gives you a discount of minus three.
I'm going to have it full so that I can make it apply to, like, swarms of people as well. I want to have it be, like, I can make a riot continue.
And I like that. That's great. And here's the write-up as an example of, like, a demo of flexibility within domain-based gifts. For example, if you have the gift of domain 4, lesser creation summoning, or animation of radio sets. Here's what the different discounts and applications mean. So again, if it's giving a plus one to the cost, that means that all domain miracles of a specific type for that estate are affected by this gift. So in the example, plus one means you can make a radio dance or appear out of nowhere or change its tune. The minus one discount applies to a large flexible subset thereof, but missing some obvious utility. So in the animation of radio sets gift, a minus one might limit you to controlling what sounds the radio emits. You can't have it, you know, just play anything. Limits what you can have come out of it. The minus two discount option is it's called a handful of applications. So minus two character point cost for the animation of radio sets gifts. A gift might limit you to having the radio play only actual radio shows. You can't actually control what comes out of it. You can just sort of tune it to what's actually on the radio. And then one trick is a discount of minus three and in the animation of radio sets, Gift, -3, might limit you to having the radio play your choice of currently broadcasting radio shows only, and just save you the effort of looking for them. So you could think about, like, I want to tune in to, you know, CKCU, the Carleton University radio station, and the radio tunes it to that, and just plays whatever CKCU is playing. So that is how the flexibility works. Flexibility determines effectively, like, how powerful your gift is, how powerful the application of your gift is, and allows you to change the amount of character points it costs to purchase that gift by being more or less restrictive. So, like, the less restrictive and more powerful your gift is, the more it costs. But if it only does one thing, then it can be really cheap to purchase. So that's why flight, the gift of flight, only costs one character point. It's because it only affects you. It does one thing and only on you. It's a very narrow application of it.
I do, I think one of the tricks for me learning to create these gifts, though, is that I would need a better understanding of the definitions of, like, divination, preservation, creation, destruction, and change. Because, like, there are certain things that, like, there are certain gifts I could come up with, but I just don't know the terminology of, like, which category to fit them into, you know? But otherwise, yeah. Like, even from the character sheet, I was able to understand the math of this pretty well. It's just, like,
I think that character sheet is a huge help. I can't imagine, like, filling one of these things in without these handy drop-downs and then having it sort of do some of the math under the table. Very handy stuff. I think that what I will do is I think we'll close it there. And what I'll do is I'll send you a copy of the source book, and maybe between, by our powers combined, we can really figure out how this thing works, how these gifts work. And you can also consult the great big lists in the source book of common gifts, uncommon gifts, and so on, to help narrow down Everett Dangler's character sheet.
Hell
right?
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, like, this is definitely some of the fun of, like, making rotes in Magic as well, is like, oh man, I made one that I can turn cheese into a knife. It's just something so I can always have a knife on hand. Because I always have cheese on hand.
Of course. Cheese knife. Can turn cheese into a knife. Not some of the knife to cut cheese.
So, is that it for our episode today? We managed to go pretty long anyway, but all right. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our supplemental materials and show notes, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Who knows the value of all the gifts they're going to come up with? Not me, but I will.
Invest your character points. Get that gift.
I'm going to try and use this whole meat.